Chapter 25. Forgery. Generally speaking, swindlers and forgers are the cleverest of all criminals. They're the very reverse of murderers, who are childish and self-defeating in their destructiveness, so much so that it's not surprising that one third of them commit suicide. From Macbeth to the Boston Strangler, they give the impression of being caught in a physical and mental trap. Forgers, however, have the scope and comparative freedom of gamblers. They're playing for high stakes, and sometimes they win and spend the rest of their lives in comfort. When they lose, it's possible for even the most law-abiding citizen to feel a twinge of sportsmanlike sympathy. At the top of this list of swashbuckling swindlers stands the name of Jim the Penman. In the Victorian age, every British schoolboy, and many in the United States, knew all about him. Nowadays, little is remembered except his nickname. His real name was James Townsend Seward, and he deserves to be immortalised as one of the most successful professional criminals of all time. For nearly a quarter of a century, he pursued a successful career of forgery, and if it had not been for the stupidity of an accomplice, he might have ended his career a rich man. Jim Seward was an intelligent, educated man with a natural gift for imitating handwriting. He could have made a success in almost any profession, and indeed he made a considerable success in his chosen profession, the law. But it was from swindling, particularly the art of forgery, that he derived real satisfaction. He was called to the bar in 1840, and by that time he had already thought long and deep on the art of forgery. It was obvious to him that the usual method, forging somebody's signature and taking the cheque to the bank, was highly dangerous. Even if the clerk handed over your money, he might remember your face. The real trick was to cover your tracks so thoroughly that there was no chance of the forgery ever being traced back to you. The plan Seward devised was elaborate and very nearly foolproof. The first move was to get hold of blank cheques. That wasn't too difficult. Burglars and pickpockets often found cheques among their loot, and they usually threw them away. Through an accomplice, he circulated a rumour in the underworld that someone might be willing to pay well for stolen cheques, either blank or used. If he could also get used cheques, so much the better. He had a signature to imitate. The next question was how to cash the forgery. Seward handed the forged cheque to an accomplice named Anderson. Anderson duly passed it on to another accomplice named Atwell. Atwell then advertised for an errand boy and a messenger, and sent him to the bank with the cheque. Atwell followed the messenger, and Anderson followed Atwell to make sure that he handed over the money. Usually there was no problem. The bank parted with the cash. By the time the forgery was discovered, the culprits were untraceable. Even if the bank became suspicious and arrested the messenger boy, there was nothing he could tell them. Atwell always took the precaution of disguising himself with a false beard and moustache when he engaged the messenger. It was this elaborate chain of command that ensured the success of Jim the Penman for so many years. His identity was known only to his closest associates. No one dreamt that the brilliant advocate James Townsend Seward, with chambers in the Temple, London, was one of the most successful criminals of the age. Like Conan Doyle's Professor Moriarty, he was a Napoleon of crime. By modern standards, his embezzlements were not large, although it must be remembered that a pound in those days would support a poor family in comfort for a week. The cheques were seldom for more than a few hundred pounds, and his real pleasure came from the employment of his skill and cunning. For example, on one occasion a burglar sold him two cheques stolen from a solicitor named Turner. Seward needed a signature of the solicitor to copy, so he sent Atwell to Turner, asking him to collect a £30 debt. The solicitor wrote an "or else" letter, demanding the money. But even with this letter in his hands, Seward was unwilling to forge the cheque. Even in those days, people guarded against forgery by using a special signature on a cheque. What he wanted was one of the solicitor's signed cheques. The debtor paid the £30, of course. He was another accomplice. Then, to Seward's annoyance, the solicitor paid the £30, minus his commission, in cash. Seward tried again. This time, the solicitor was asked to collect a debt of £103.15.6. Because it was such an odd sum, the solicitor voluntarily paid by cheque. Seward had the signature he needed, and the solicitor was soon poorer by £400. Inevitably, there came a day when luck ceased to favour the master forger. One cashier at a Lombard Street bank became suspicious when the messenger asked for £1,000 in the form of 5 £100 notes, 8 £50 notes, and the rest in gold. He peered very closely at the bill of exchange and decided it was forged. The innocent messenger was seized, but an accomplice who had been waiting outside the bank was able to warn Sayward, and the gang escaped, as usual. A few failures of this sort convinced Sayward to try a wider field, the provinces. It was a bad decision. To begin with, the gang was short of funds, and Sayward was feeling harassed. Always a bad state of mind for a confident swindler. It seems to induce bad luck. They decided to work the usual trick in the east coast town of Yarmouth, get solicitors to collect debts, and then forge their signatures on cheques. An accomplice named Hardwick opened a bank account in London with £250, using the false name of Whitney. The money was then transferred to Yarmouth. In Yarmouth, Hardwick visited various solicitors using another false name, Ralph. In due course, he ran short of money and went to the bank. It was only then that he realised that he had forgotten to request the bank to pay out the cash to a man by the name of Ralph. The bank naturally refused to pay Mr. Whitney's money to Mr. Ralph, and Ralph was in no position to tell them that he was Whitney. Anxiously, he wrote to Sayward for instructions. If Sayward had not been harassed and impatient, he would have realised that the best plan was to forget the money, for the bank was already suspicious. Instead, he wrote Ralph a detailed and compromising letter, instructing him to return to London and to start all over again. By the time it reached Yarmouth, the bank had already told the police of their suspicions, and the police were questioning Ralph and Atwell. The letter arrived while they were in custody and was promptly opened by the police. The men in Yarmouth confessed and saved themselves by turning Queen's evidence. Jim the penman and his accomplice, Anderson, however, went on trial in March 1857 and were sentenced to transportation for life. Sayward was lucky. Until 1837, by which time he'd already commenced operations, forgery was punishable by death. The penalty had not always been so savage. To begin with, the chief offenders in the Middle Ages were priests, the only class who could write, and they usually claimed benefit of the clergy and escaped with only a light punishment. In the time of Queen Elizabeth I, a forger could be fined, put in the pillory, have his nostrils slit, and lose his ears. But until there were banknotes, the forger's opportunities were obviously limited. There had been banknotes in Lombardy, in Italy, as long ago as the 12th century, hence Lombard Street, London's banking centre. But it wasn't until 1694 that they made their appearance in England. They were called accountable notes, or running cash notes, and since they were handwritten, they invited forgery. The first one was detected a mere 2 weeks after they were first issued, on July the 31st, 1694. It was for £100, and the four culprits were heavily fined and placed in the pillory. Since the gains could be so enormous and the crime so easy to commit, the criminal only needed a pen and a piece of paper, the bankers became alarmed. As a result, forgery was made punishable by death in 1697. In one classic case of the 18th century, the new law was used to hang a villain who had been evading justice for years. The notorious James Bolland was, oddly enough, an officer of the law, an office he procured by the simple expedient of paying for it. This meant that he could arrest people for debt and take them to jail in his own good time. He hired a dockside house in Southwark in London and put bars in the windows and ran it as a cross between a hotel and a prison, where debtors with money to spare could eat and sleep in comfort. This was perfectly legal, but Bolland's hotel was really a clip joint, where his prisoners were parted from their money by every known means. Bolland was an expert card sharp, and then hurried into the less comfortable atmosphere of Newgate Prison just as soon as they were penniless. For years, Bolland continued his career of fraud and extortion with great success. Then he made a slip. He was holding a post-dated note of hand, basically a cheque or an IOU, for £100, and he asked an acquaintance to cash it at a small discount. Like any cheque, it had to be endorsed, so Bolland wrote his name on it. His friend protested. He intended to cash the note with a third person, and Bolland was so notorious that this name would make it hard to negotiate. Obligingly, Bolland erased his name and wrote Banks instead. In doing so, he had technically committed forgery, although no fraud was involved because the note was perfectly good. Unfortunately for Bolland, the man who originally wrote the IOU went bankrupt. The man who had cashed it, a Mr. Cardineau, demanded his money. As usual, the slippery Bolland tried to evade his responsibility. He looked at the IOU and said that his name was not Banks. But Cardineau mentioned the transaction to an officer of the law. The authorities had been waiting for a long time for an excuse to get Bolland behind bars. He was arrested, tried for forgery, and executed in March of 1772. That was not the only time the forgery laws were stretched to secure a conviction. In September 1803, a confidence trickster named John Hadfield was executed for what really amounted to seduction of a pretty waitress. Hadfield was a gambler who liked to pose as the Honourable Augustus Hope. In 1802, he arrived in the English Lake District, which had been made popular by the poems of Wordsworth and Coleridge, and he did his best to lure a rich heiress into marriage. He signed the name Honourable Augustus Hope on various bills, but swindling was not part of his plan. He only wanted to get the lady. Her father became suspicious, so the Honourable Augustus went off and married, bigamously, the pretty daughter of an innkeeper at Buttermere, Mary Robinson. The girl was already something of a minor celebrity because she had been the subject of a well-known poem called Sally of Buttermere. Just as she thought she'd acquired a rich husband, the Honourable Augustus was arrested as a fraud. He succeeded in escaping, and during the months he was on the run, the story of the wronged beauty of Buttermere caught the imagination of the English people. Hadfield was finally caught and tried for forgery, when in fact his crime was that of bigamy. The only case of forgery to achieve a place in the Notable British Trials series is also one of the most tragic. Henry Fauntleroy was a brilliant young businessman who started his career in 1800 as a clerk in his father's bank in Berners Street in London. Times were bad, and when his father died in 1807, Fauntleroy realised that they were on the edge of bankruptcy. He applied all his energy and intelligence to remaining solvent, and inspired so much confidence that the bank was soon attracting crowds of investors. But things were not as good as they looked. The war with Napoleon was strangling trade. Fauntleroy was juggling the books, selling stocks and shares belonging to his depositors whenever he required money, and quickly replacing them when they were needed. All this demanded a certain amount of forgery of depositors' signatures. Like all gamblers, Fauntleroy pinned his hopes on eventually making a fortune that would wipe out all his debts. But as the debts rose to £400,000, it became more difficult to cook the books. In 1824, when he was 40, the crash came. Fauntleroy was the executor of many wills. In the case of the will of a Lieutenant Colonel Bellis, the other executors wanted to hand over their responsibilities to the Court of Chancery, and they were puzzled when Fauntleroy hysterically disagreed with this. They went to the Bank of England one day and discovered that most of Colonel Bellis's stocks and shares had been sold, and the proceeds transferred to Fauntleroy's bank. The banker was duly found guilty and was executed on November the 30th, 1824. One of the most successful and improbable forgers of this fresh breed was a mild little American named Edward Merler. Outwardly, he appeared to lack the quirky, devious and off-centre mind so essential to the forger in his work. To his friends and neighbours in New York City, he was a nice old man who had led a peaceful and uneventful life as the superintendent of an East Side apartment block. He retired from legitimate work in 1937 and then set about making money in the literal sense. A widower with a married daughter living away from him, he spent most of his time alone with his dog in his tiny apartment on 96th Street. After an unsuccessful venture as a junk dealer, he bought an antiquated printing press and installed it in one of his rooms. He already possessed an old stand camera, and he spent his few remaining dollars on chemicals and supplies. Now he was ready to manufacture his first $1 bill. He photographed a genuine bill, made a plate of it, and, using the wrong sort of paper and incorrect shades of ink, turned out some sample bills. They were crude, they were clumsy. But Merler wasn't worried about that. He knew from experience that no one bothered to examine a $1 bill closely. A five, yes. A ten, certainly. But not a one. So providing he spent them wisely, he figured that his crime would not be discovered. Or at least, not traced back to him. Each day he took his dog for a walk along 96th Street and stopped at a store, a bar or a tobacco kiosk to make a purchase. He was an extremely careful shopper. If an item cost, say, $4, he would pay for it with three real notes and one of his own. That way he never passed more than one counterfeit bill at a time, and when he had exhausted the possibilities of shopping on his home street, he went further afield, still getting rid of a Merler dollar everywhere he went and with everything he bought. Before long, the dud bills were taken by their new and angry owners to the police. Puzzled by the apparent pettiness of the offence, after all, what was the point of forging $1 bills so obviously and so badly? The police did not at first regard the affair very seriously. They warned local shopkeepers and bank tellers to be on the lookout for the bills, and then they got on with the more serious business of the day, such as hunting down murderers and armed robbers. By the end of 1938, however, some 6,000 forged bills had been circulated, and the source showed no sign of drying up. Working quietly at home, flashing his camera, turning his press, Murner continued to make the notes, even when his printing plates became dirty and ridiculously worn. By then, the money would have fooled no one, except perhaps a child who looked more than casually at it. But no one did, and Murner spent the next 10 years slaving over a hot press. Methodically, unhurriedly, never losing his confidence or his patience, he continued with the hobby that lent interest to his old age. He was also, although he didn't suspect it, the subject of a large-scale police investigation into the manufacture and disposal of the notes. As the officers got nowhere, there were no leads, no clues, no underworld informers, James Maloney, chief of the New York branch of the American Secret Service, took over the case. Before long, he too had to admit that he was baffled and bamboozled. If the forgeries were the work of one man, then the man was an idiot and an incompetent. His dollar bills were nothing more than a bad joke, and only bigger idiots would have been taken in by them. If it was the work of a gang, then it was an extremely secretive and discreet one. Also, it was perversely clever, trying to kid the authorities that its members were not professional crooks or forgers. Edward Murler might have gone on until his death, making and distributing his bills at no more than one or two a day. But then disaster came. One afternoon, while out exercising his dog, and incidentally making a couple of $1 purchases, fire broke out in his apartment. The fire brigade was called and his rooms forced into. In an attempt to save his humble possessions, firemen threw everything salvageable out of the window, including some printing plates and some half-burnt pieces of paper. The paper was picked up by an inquisitive boy whose father handed it to the police. The charred scraps were, in fact, forged bills. And when Murler returned home, he found a group of detectives waiting for him. They were as surprised as he was, and could hardly believe that here was the person they had been seeking for the last 10 years. The scourge of the Secret Service, the pest of the police force. Murler was arrested, taken to court, and sentenced to 9 months' imprisonment for his career as a master forger. On his release, he went to live with his daughter and his son-in-law. He was allowed to take his dog with him, but his camera and his printing press were kept from him for good.